for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Jaron Lanier is a computer scientist and musician. He's often described as visionary for his work in the field of virtual reality. He helped create Silicon Valley startups that are now parts of Google and Adobe. Time magazine listed him as one of the most influential people in the world. He now works on special projects for Microsoft Research. But Lanier is also a critic of the ways digital technology is transforming our culture and economy. Lanier's new book is titled, Who Owns the Future? He joins me here in the studio. You're always welcome to be part of the program. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, Jaron.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
Good to have you here. You write in the book that you're concerned that the digital networks that you helped create are hurting the middle class. Describe how.
Sure. Well, you know, when my colleagues and I worked on getting digital networking to be operational, we always anticipated that when it was introduced, we'd see a wave of fresh prosperity. We'd see a wave of well-being. We'd see people doing better in their lives. And the reason we believe that is that's what technologists always want to see. We always, that's what we saw with the advent of plumbing or vaccinations or the freeways or electricity. And, you know, not always perfectly, but generally you will always see that. I mean, why else do these things? What's the purpose otherwise? And once networking became available, I was shocked and disappointed to see its effect on the world. And I know there are some triumphs that are often talked about. Maybe it played a role in the Arab Spring. I actually have my doubts about that, but let's say it did. In the developed world, what we've seen is an increase in income concentration. We've seen austerity. We've seen jobless recoveries. We've seen a loss of social mobility. We've seen a hollowing out of the labor market where middle class jobs are harder to come by and more people end up either on top or on the bottom. Not too many on top. And I started to worry, like, why are we not seeing the benefits? And when I looked at it, I realized that we hadn't really thought through what we were doing well enough.
Let's just take income concentration as one of the things that you are concerned about and talk about how the growth of Silicon Valley and everything that we now know and use has concentrated wealth.
It's not just Silicon Valley. It's perhaps even more Wall Street. But what we found is that if you want to connect a bunch of people on a digital network and they're all sharing their information, you might think that's a wonderful open situation that should make things better. But here's the problem. Even if people are created equal, computers are not. And some of those people are going to have bigger computers than the others. And those that have the biggest computers have this extraordinary advantage, even if they didn't realize they were going to get it in advance. Their big computers, just as a matter of course, calculate things about the world that give them an overview. It allows them to analyze what everybody else is doing. It allows them to predict people's behavior. It allows them to notice opportunities in marketplaces and all sorts of things. And that inequality of that exists between the people with the ordinary computers and the giant computers ends up concentrating wealth and power faster than any other technology in history.
Are you also talking about the quickness of those computers?
Right. I'm kind of smudging a bit here, because to really talk about it properly, takes quite a long time. It's not just that the computer's big, although that matters. It has to be fast. It has to be very well connected.
Yeah.
And you have to have very good people programming it. And so there's, of course, a tremendous race to hire the best recent PhDs from the top schools.
It's interesting you use the example of Kodak as compared to Instagram, the online photo sharing company. Talk about that.
Sure. Our friends up in Rochester, New York, are the descendants of ancestors who thrived in the buggy whip industry once upon a time. When it became obsolete, new jobs arose with the rise of photography, and Kodak and Polaroid were in the same place there in Rochester. And it's interesting that people were still being paid, even though the jobs working at Kodak were easier than the jobs taking care of horses and buggies. And I love horses, but it is a lot of work, you know. And somehow we decided as a society that even though the jobs were becoming more pleasant and less dangerous, people could still be paid for them. But then something happened at the turn of this century where we decided, wow, you know, we're building an information age, but we're going to make information free. That's not something people will be paid for. So suddenly what happens is only the people who own the biggest computer that routes the information make all the money, and everybody else who actually creates the value doesn't. So Instagram only had 13 employees when they sold themselves to Facebook for $1 billion. I think they deserve their success, but the point is they did it in a particular way, which is dysfunctional, which is by shrinking the middle class, because Kodak had employed 140,000 people, and not just employed them like entry-level jobs. These were good middle-class jobs. And so you have this winner-take-all society that results because the winners are the people who end up being close to the best computers.
So how is it that these companies make their fortune by selling the information of their users to advertisers while the users get nothing?
Well, the way it works is you use your big computer to calculate little ways that you can get advantages gradually over other people, so the other people have to pay the costs and take the risks. And the terminology is different for each kind of big computer, but it's all quite similar. In the case of finance, what happens is you offer people cheap and easy mortgages, they get into it, but you have the computational power to leverage and bundle them and get the benefits and leave everybody else to pay for the increased risk, the loss of the tightness of credit, the loss of even national credit rating. When it's social media, when it's Silicon Valley companies, what happens is you give people free services like social networks and search. But in order to do that, you have to make what they do in the information world free, so their own career prospects are diminished. And I know there are some listeners who are going to be saying, but when you give away your stuff for free, you get so many benefits, you can promote yourself. Doesn't it all balance out in your favor? And boy, do I know that argument, because I helped make it up. And what happens actually is when you give away your information, you do gain a chance to promote yourself, but you enter into an informal economy. You might get reputation benefits, and you might get a chance to sing for your supper more easily, but that's not the same thing as formal benefits, real money, real wealth. You can't plan for retirement on that. You can't have kids on that. You can't afford to get sick. You really have to be kind of a kid living with your parents to pull that off.
Jaron Lanier, his new book is titled Who Owns the Future? Time magazine listed him as one of the most influential people in the world. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Tell me how you grew up and how you got to be listed as one of the most influential people in the world. And why?
Oh, who knows what they were thinking, Megan?
Tell me
about
yourself.
You say this
yourself.
As if it makes sense.
Tell me about yourself.
Well, let me see. The short version is I grew up in a little town in New Mexico I think my parents wanted to go to the end of the road, away from the world. My mom was a concentration camp survivor, and my dad's family had been mostly wiped out by pogroms in Russia. So they wanted obscurity. They perceived it as, I think, safety. And as it happened, weirdly, what to them was obscurity, to me was opportunity, because we ended up right near the White Sands missile range, and there were extraordinary scientists and engineers around creating weapons. So one of my near neighbors was the fellow who discovered Pluto, Clyde Tombaugh, and he was the...
Pluto no longer considered a planet.
Oh, listen, I am sorry. Pluto's a planet. I'm not going to buy into this.
Yeah, of course it is.
When somebody agrees that Europe's not a continent, I'll agree that Pluto's not a planet. But he was also the head of optics research, and he taught me to make lenses, and he used to let me use big telescopes when I was a little kid. And there are many other examples. There was a wonderful early computer center at the university there, New Mexico State. So it actually weirdly turned into an opportunity for this weird little sort of lonely kid to have access to possibly a better technology education than I would have had anywhere else at a very young age, because of the generosity and the sort of openness of the science and engineering community, which is one of the things I really love about it. And so that gave me a great early start. And I had some other very, very good episodes of good fortune. I was very lucky to meet the right people and be in the right places.
Did you go to university?
Well, what happened was, yes, I went to university very young and did very well. And then I just felt I had to go to an art school and be an artist. And then of course, I flunked out of that. So I never actually finished any real degrees. I do have some honorary ones.
Jared Lanier, his new book is titled Who Owns the Future? Do join us. I look forward to speaking with you. And if you've just joined us, Jaron Lanier is with me in this hour. His new book is titled, Who Owns the Future? He is the author of You Are Not a Gadget. And the cover, how do you interpret the cover?
Well,
it's sort of information exploding, is it not?
I was thinking that the big white circle was the biggest computer sucking all the benefits out of all the little orange circles. But I actually never talked to the artist who made the cover.
You so did not.
I do not know what it means.
Interesting. All right. Here's an email from Adam, who says, we hear a lot about digital entrepreneurs and venture capitalists. Shouldn't there be an organization dedicated to assisting creative groups and individuals to learn how to exploit and make use of the power of big computers, i.e., get them to the point of being able to make a proposal to the venture capitalists? For example, there's a crying need for new sources of income and new distributors for documentary productions.
Right. So It's very difficult. I think the analogy that I like to make is to the American West in a much earlier era, where you had the free land that people could go out, but to get access to their land, they had to use monopolized transportation systems, the railroad barons and whatnot. And we have something like that on the internet. We have this illusion of free that's actually enriching a class that is actually, I think, in a technical sense, not monopoly, but is sort of a new kind of monopoly, maybe. And what we need to do is change the system. And I get emails all the time from people who have ideas about creating little organizations or startups or things. And the truth is that the system is kind of overwhelming as it is. And this is why I feel like I need to speak out about it. I think bottom up organizations are wonderful, and they can do a lot of things in the short term, perhaps, and something like this might work, although I'll tell you, the venture capitalists will give you a tough time with those things, because the biggest computers are really swallowing up the income. You know, I think you'd have a rough time of it. But what we really need to do is have a societal discussion about changing the system. And in my view, we have 2 or 3 decades to do it, so we have some time, but now is the time to start talking.
You write that free translation services on Google are an example of people not being paid for their work. So explain that.
Sure. So it seems like magic that you can upload some text in English and get it back in Spanish. And Google and Microsoft both offer that now, and it's usable. It's not perfect. And the way we talk about it is as if there's some electronic brain, and it's if it's doing a favor for us to give us access for free to this electronic brain. But that's not the truth. The way it actually works is real translations by real translators were gathered in the thousands, and without pay, by the way. And then we do pattern matching of your text to examples from those things. And we create a mashup of little elements of translations that were done in the past. And that mashup is actually workable. And that's what it is. So anytime you see a claim that there's some electronic brain that you're getting access to for free, what's actually going on is there's a whole crowd of people who weren't paid. So in a way, artificial intelligence is kind of an accounting fraud intrinsically.
But why would they do it for free?
They had no choice. Nobody asks. You know, that's the thing, is that you just scoop up the data.
I see.
You're being observed by cameras. Your emails are being scanned these days. Everything, you know, everybody wants data. Every time you go on a news site, there's little spying services that are tracking where you go. It might be true on your website. I don't know, but it is on most.
So, in other words, what you are saying is that the idea that information on the web should be free is actually harmful to the economy.
In the long term, and I need to be clear about the time frame I'm talking about. Right now, the people who are disenfranchised are in a way always underlings. They're the journalists, the photographers, the musicians, and so forth, the translators now. But as we see technology progress in the coming decades, more and more stuff will be automated. So cars are starting to drive themselves. Cars are already safer driven by robots than by people. We've seen robotic pharmacists and legal researchers outperform humans. But the thing is, whenever this happens, it's not because the machines are really autonomous. What automation really means is that there's a whole crowd of people providing the data that the machines use to create the illusion that they're autonomous. So at some point, when more and more jobs start going away, if we're not willing to pay people for that information that actually drives the machines that are doing those jobs, we'll face a crisis where we either have to suddenly turn into a socialist society, which I don't think would be a pretty transition or a pretty result. I know some people do think that would be pretty. I'm not among them. Or something. I mean, and so what we have to do is change the system before we hit that breaking point.
How close are we to that breaking point?
I'm thinking 20 or 30 years.
And what could be done in this 20 or 30 years to change that outcome?
Well, what we need to do is exactly what we did with the American West. We need to move away from a system where the land was taken from the Native Americans who lived there, given for free to new people, but only in a system where they could access it through a monopoly transportation system. We need to move from that to a world where people can buy and sell property, and they can start to have a bit of wealth and clout on their own with public public freeways to get them to their land so that they're not beholden to somebody else in order to access their own wealth. We need to create a real economy, because when people are able to be first-class citizens and find their own way, I think a middle class will arise. But we're not allowing that online. Instead, we're creating a winner-take-all society online.
So who are the winners right now?
Well, so to ask who the winners are, you have to ask which are the biggest or the most powerful computers. And so I can give you a rundown of some of the big ones. The most egregious ones at the moment are the Wall Street computers, the high-frequency trading machines, the ones that bundle derivatives and have brought austerity and a credit crisis to the whole developed world at once. But those, if you visit those machines and meet the people and get to know the code, which I've had an opportunity to do, they're extremely similar. I mean, it's really just a coding of terminology that distinguishes them from the computers in Silicon Valley at Facebook or Google that run social networking and search. They're essentially the same. They're gathering huge amounts of data from the world and performing statistics to create models of everybody, and then selling the results to parties who can benefit from predicting what individuals are going to do. An example is the crisis in American health insurance, where with big computers, you can predict who's going to get sick a little bit more accurately. So you can try to create the perfect business where you only insure the people who are unlikely to need it. And we all know what happens. You eject so much risk and cost into the society that it can't sustain it. And that's happened in finance. It's happened in healthcare. It will happen with social media and search as people start losing their jobs. Modern elections are another example. When you look at national elections and now state elections, even, you're seeing these giant computing engines that target people and fine-tune messages. So that's turning into it. And let us not forget the national intelligence organizations around the world, which are also becoming similar. They're also running the same types of algorithms run by the same types of scientists.
Do you have any hopes whatsoever that the very young generation, I mean the very young, the 10, 12, 13-year-olds, will building on the knowledge that's already there in terms of who has and who has not, will find a way to begin to level the playing field, or will they simply take advantage of what's there and push forward on their own? In other words, are we creating a more selfish society?
I'm absolutely optimistic. I have absolutely no doubt that a new generation will fix this. The question is which generation it'll be. So the popular way of thinking is that it's the young and hip way to be is to give all your information to private corporations in California and then complain about the state of your life. And at some point, people will realize that that's crazy. They'll realize that every time you use social media to complain about society, that very act is concentrating wealth and power in a small elite and undoing your intention. So at some point, somebody's going to notice, hey, wait a second, this is ridiculous. You know, and I don't think it'll happen with current teenagers, current 12-year-olds, maybe. But, you know, it will happen because people aren't that stupid. People will get it. But I think the earlier we start talking about it, the sooner we'll start to be able to have the substantial conversation and figure out how to get out of this.
How old were you when you first looked at a personal computer?
Wow. It depends what you think a personal computer was. I remember the little kits, the Altairs and that sort of stuff. I guess I must have been 16 or something. It was in the 70s.
And what happened?
Well, I had access to much bigger computers. So I had a little bit of fun making those and playing with them, but I was kind of more interested in the bigger computers. So I had, at the time, I was able to really work with what in those days was considered the big iron. And so when I moved to California, I must have been 18 or 19, and I got to know the people at the nascent Apple computer and all these places. And then I got the personal computer bug. And in my early 20s, I had the good fortune to be successful writing games for them at one point. And I enjoyed the little computers. They were great. They still are.
You made lots of money yourself.
You know, I've had a funny thing about money in my life. I made a lot of money about four times and then lost it trying to do something else. And I've gotten to this point of having an indeterminate class status where it's sort of always going up and down. Now I have a daughter, so I'm trying to not live such a... But I've gone back and forth between...
Well, tell me how you lost it. First, how you made that first pile of money and how you lost it.
Well, I guess the first time I did well was I wrote a video game that nobody would remember now called Moondust in 82 or something that at the time was very successful. And it was a kind of a cool psychedelic music improvisation, groovy sort of an experience game. And it did well. And then I got all the money from it and I poured it into building virtual reality machines. And that turned into a little startup that Sun eventually bought, but only after a very complicated bankruptcy. So essentially the money I made went into starting this thing and I didn't make money back out of it. And then I repeated that sort of cycle a bunch of times. I've always been a little bit more into the technology than the business side. And I tend to not be that good on this sort of stage where you stare down the investors and you're supposed to cash out. That part kind of bores me to tears.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Shall we take some callers now?
Yeah.
Let's do it. And first to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Bill. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I hadn't heard of your book, Mr. Lanier, but I'm definitely going to look into it because it sounds really interesting.
Good.
I liked the example of Kodak versus Instagram that you gave. But to me, and I haven't been around as long as you, I'm only 28 years old, it always seemed like a sort of obvious conclusion that computers would replace and eliminate certain types of human work and consumer goods. And that's what they've always been used for. And thinking about Adam Smith, who defined monetary value as relative to human work, I'm wondering if you think that we'll need to redefine monetary value as some sort of positive computer time and human work in the future?
Well, I think if we define value in terms of what people want will actually be okay. And here's what I mean by that. Let me bring up another figure who's Abraham Maslow, who was a psychologist who pointed out that the concept of what's really needed shifts over time, that these days we really need electricity, but electricity was a luxury at first. And so if you look at what people really like, they like seeing what each other are up to on social media. If that was monetized, looking at the way information flows in social media, it would create a middle class out of pure information.
How would you monetize it?
Well, see, that's the big transition. This is like the question of how did the West move out of its initial phase,
yeah,
where land was free and gunslingers ruled and railroad barons profited.
And that's the comparison.
Yeah, that is.
You know,
and it's there's a great old movie called Liberty Valance, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, that is about that transition in the West. And I grew up in the West. I grew up in a town where people still wandered around with horses and rifles and shot each other now and then. So I saw the tail end of it. And it's not an easy transition, but it's the one we have to start to make. And I know that to many people who are used to something like Facebook, their reaction is probably like they think it sounds crazy. Like, why would I pay for this? And also, this is fluff, you know. But the thing is, if you follow the information, if you look at the information that makes everything work, that makes the computers operate, you will find people at the origin. And if you just decide that that's actually real value, which it is, all of a sudden we get back a middle class, even when the machines get really good. Approximately. I mean, I'm oversimplifying it here. There are all kinds of issues, but it's a simple idea. It's not something that can be undertaken quickly. It'll require a shift in values and it'll take some time, but I don't see any other way out.
What about the music industry, which you are clearly a part of as a musician yourself?
Mm-hmm. Well, the music business used to support a very large middle class population. In fact, at the turn of the century, if you look at tax data, you'll see that there were I think almost a third of a million Americans earning more than $100,000. So good middle class jobs in the music business, and mostly not as musicians, but as just part of the industry. So we have to understand that when music was demonetized, it's not just that we're putting musicians into a informal economic life that you'd normally associate with slums in the developing world, you know, where they have to live gig to gig. But you're also throwing away this whole world of good jobs. You're killing a General Motors type of ecosystem. And that's what we did. And at you know, in the 90s, I used to join in all of my musician friends and hate the labels because that was the cool thing to do. But now that they're gone, I miss them.
Jaron Lanier, his new book is titled Who Owns the Future? We'll keep talking. Take your calls, your email. I look forward to speaking with you.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. And by the John A. Hartford Foundation, working to improve the health of older Americans at jhartfound.org. This is NPR.
How angry am I? You don't want to know. Nobody wants to know. That's the opening lines of Claire Massoud's new novel, The Woman Upstairs. It's about a single woman who hasn't fulfilled her dream of being an artist and a mother. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Massoud, who also wrote the bestseller, The Emperor's Children. Join us.
Jaron Lanier is with me. He has been called by Time Magazine one of the most influential people in the world. Here's an email from Karen. It says, "It has occurred to me that with online learning and so many prestigious schools offering free online courses, that far fewer professors will be needed in the future." What's your comment?
Yeah, so I think the idea of making learning more available and using technology to do it is wonderful. Yeah. It's like been one of them. I've worked on that myself a lot, and of course it's lovely, but into the current regime in which we're operating, where so much power accrues around whoever has the biggest computer because the information is free and there's no balance, it'll destroy education. I mean, it'll backfire. It'll create early treats in the way that, you know, financiers use big computers to get out all those easy to accept mortgages, but then in the long term, you pay for it. I remember watching all those bright kids in Egypt in Tahrir Square who had used social media to help topple a dictator. And then I thought, my God, none of them will ever be professors. They're sending all their information to companies in California. You know, they're not creating their own wealth structure around information that could sustain people to have jobs as professors. You know, you could be a professor by using social media to get reputation and crash on people's couches and sing for your supper for every meal, just like musicians do today. But if you want to have kids or whatever, it won't work. And so, yeah, we're sort of eating our own seed corn. It's the way we're doing it. So we could do it if information was valued. We could still do it. I mean, the problem is not making education available online. The problem is doing it in the context of the power structure where all the wealth and power accrues to the big computers. So it's really a good thing that's currently made gloomy because of this other contextual problem. Can I just say one other thing about education? On the one hand, you could say, well, there's more information available than ever before because of the internet.
Right.
But there's a funny thing about that. Because of the way we're doing things, big computers tend to accrue all the influence and all the attention. So, for instance, in the paper era, it would never have occurred to anyone to say there should only be one encyclopedia. There was an Encyclopedia Britannica and an Encyclopedia Americana, and it was understood that they all were written by people and they had points of view, and that's why there were multiple ones. But because of the way we're doing things, there's something called network effect, where as soon as you accumulate a lot of people on a network, you get so much influence that it outstrips other people attempting to rise up to compete with you. So the Wikipedia becomes the only encyclopedia for a lot of people, even for like topics in the humanities where there can't be a single point of view. And that's going to start happening with education, where at first it'll seem like we're supporting diversity, but actually we're destroying it. But the way out is not to say, don't put technology online, don't put education online. The way out of it is to change the power system so that having the biggest computer isn't the ticket to infinite wealth.
But how do you begin the change process?
Well, this is, of course,
back to the gunslingers.
So, you know, I faced a problem with this book in that I could have just said, here's the problem and we must find a solution, and then stopped. And then I thought, no, that's not courageous. Even if I don't quite know the path forward, I have to start to sketch it as much as I can.
Yeah.
And of course, that makes me vulnerable because people will look at it and they'll say, oh my God, his alternative is ridiculous.
It's all wrong.
You know, and I'm not claiming to have all the answers. I do feel I understand the problem. I think the answer has to start with, I think it's a little bit like modernizing the West, and it's a little bit like the union movement. It has to involve both bottom-up and top-down efforts at the same time. I think it will involve a cultural change. I think it'll involve maybe people having to see more of the suffering emerge as this process continues. They're going to have to see the community colleges closing and all but the star colleges, you know, suffering before they realize that we're actually damaging education. They're going to have to look at the fact that they don't have prospects themselves to become a professor before they realize that we're doing it the wrong way.
And isn't that almost too late?
Well, see, this is why we start talking now. I think people always find a way. I'm actually really optimistic. I think we'll find a way out of global climate change, and I think we'll find a way out of this. The two are related, by the way, because we only know about global climate change because of big computing. And in order for us to be able to perceive the fruits of big computing without corruption, we need to get the corruption out of big computing. You know, and so there's actually a connection between the problems. I'm totally optimistic we'll get it. And I think by talking about it this early in the game, the chances are improved. So, you know, but people always squeak by. We always do it.
To Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Diane and Jared. I'm so glad you're on this program. I'm excited to read your book. I wanted to ask you what your opinion is about the fact that so many kids today are falling way behind because they don't have tangible physical skills, yet they are totally users of the internet. I teach part-time in high school, and I've been part of competitive robotics for 10 years, and so I have been... First off, I remember a world without, like, widespread internet, whereas my brother, who's 4 years younger, does not. And I'm just trying to gauge what we do about a generation of kids whose entire experience is, by and large, digital. And moved from the physical?
Well, okay, there are a lot of different angles to this. There's one angle, which is what we're doing to the ability to learn and to attention and so forth. I won't address that. I'll direct people to Sherry Turkle's work to address that. She's excellent on that point. What I will address is two other issues, though. One of them is this way that kids are growing up in an excessively pre-constructed world and I think not learning to confront reality directly. So what I mean by that is they grow, and I'm part of this as a parent now, it's hard to escape this pattern, but our kids grow up in ultra-structured lives where play dates are organized and they never are just like, hey, you're bored, go out and play. You know, they never invent their own lives. They never go out and play and deal with the dirt and have to deal, you know, well, it's not that they never do, but there's so much pre-construction in their lives. And then when they enter the internet a little older, they are dealing with this highly structured world where everybody's categorized, they're single, they're all these labels and everybody's routed through these networks according to algorithms. They're algorithms that model what they should listen to, who they should date when they get old enough. My concern about that is that if you're not dealing with reality directly, you can't be a scientist, you can't be a good engineer, you can't be a good artist. There's a kind of an artificiality. And I'm deeply concerned that if we use technology that way, we're using it incorrectly. But right now, all the incentives, all the monetary incentives are to get people into that artificial world so you can model them and manipulate them, because that's where the money and the power are for all the types of big computers I just mentioned, financial, electoral, everything. So that's a huge, huge issue. I don't know. I mean, this all happened very quickly. It's going to take us some effort. Mm. I very strongly urge everyone, though, to try to fight back on this trope that to be young is to give yourself to Facebook. Because what a stupid way to be young and creative to say I'm beholden to some company in California. I mean, that one thing I think should be defeatable. And I have nothing against Facebook, by the way. I like the people there. I have a lot of friends there. And I think Facebook would do tons better, actually. I'm not anti-corporate. I think they do tons better in a world of monetized information, because then the economy would grow instead of shrink when we acknowledge the value that's being created.
All right. To St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Tara.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm in St. Louis. I work on a civic tech project here called City Pulse that wants to collect and visualize data about cities in real time. And it's basically to keep citizens and policymakers more informed. And because of that, one of our guiding tenets is to make sure that we are keeping what we do equitably accessible in the communities we work in. St. Louis is a very segregated city socioeconomically, and we have entire neighborhoods that have no ground-wired connectivity to the internet, for example. So more at the neighborhood level, on the individual level, information is actually not free. And so my question is how, you know, in the information age, when even the United Nations declares internet access a basic human right, what can we do to motivate the oligarchy of telecommunications companies, to motivate our government to make information and, you know, access to internet cheaper, better? My understanding is that the U.S. is actually behind a lot of other countries in terms of connectivity, and I'm wondering what role the government can have or what we as citizens can have in changing that.
Okay, well, this is an interesting question, and my answer has to be somewhat complex. So on the one hand, there's this issue of sort of where I am in the cycle versus where your question is. So your question is utterly valid, but I'm in a sense looking at the world beyond your question. So this issue of having just raw access and corporate interests charging too much and excluding people is very much an important issue, and it's an issue of the present. The problem is that let's suppose we solved that and everybody had access and we no longer had economic restrictions. Then we'd enter into the world where the biggest computers on that thing they had access to would still be regimenting them, you know, and grabbing all the value. So in a sense, I'm dealing with the problem on the horizon beyond the horizon that you're dealing with. That doesn't make your problem invalid at all. In fact, it's a huge one, and it bugs me greatly. What we see is that when we declare something to be free, something else gets really expensive. When you buy a photo printer, it's incredibly cheap, but somehow the ink is insanely expensive. And if you try to get cheaper ink, it doesn't really work. And the music is free, but your wireless bill becomes insanely expensive somehow, even if it's not supposed to be. And this keeps on happening. And this is very much like the railroad barons and the free land in the West. We have this level that we call free, but then access to it. There's something about it that's actually hyper expensive. So now, as to how to deal with the American situation as opposed to the general world situation, the history in America is twisted. It's very strange. I can recommend Tim Wu's book, The Master Switch, for a bit of the history. There's one part I want to mention, which is Al Gore actually kind of did. He never said he invented the internet, but I'll say it for him. He kind of did, because the technology for networking was around, but it was fragmented, and the idea of a unified thing that would work for everybody was really government funded. It was really pulled together. There was a thing called the Gore Bill that did it. I was there. I saw him do it. He was really smart about it, and he was following in the footsteps of his dad, who'd worked on the interstate highway, with a similar analogy that people should be able to get to their land without being beholden to some sort of interest or bottleneck on the way. What happened as a result of that was I keep on hearing these jokes about him, like it's become this trope. Like, so if a politician is going to be smart and is going to try to do something of use, they face a lifetime of ridicule because somehow it's just hard in America to do that. So I think, you know, in a way, one of the steps is to try to stop ridiculing our politicians who actually do something smart, like maybe give them some credit once in a while. And Al Gore would be a great example.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Jaron, I want to ask a very personal question of you, and that is your appearance. I want to ask you about your decision, for example, to let your hair grow so long, it's almost down your back, and in these tiny little curls. It's got to be political decision.
No, I can't tell you how little I think about it. I mean, really what happened was, at a certain point in my 20s, there's some pictures of me with kind of normal hair, but I worked so hard trying to comb the kinks out every single day, and it hurt. And at a certain point, I just thought, I don't have time for this. It's just too much work. And I just didn't want to fight my hair. It just it wanted to turn into dreadlocks, and it always did. It did. If I let it go even a little bit, it would start to form into them. And it was just too much damn work to try to fight it. And it's really nothing beyond that. I had no contact with Jamaican culture. I have no. There is something funny, which is one time my mom's from Vienna, and one time I was in the Vienna train station, and I saw some kids with dreadlocks, and they turned out to be some of the few remaining Jews in Vienna, and there's obviously some strain, and they had this natural problem too. There's some strain of hair around there that's like that, and it's interesting to speculate how that might have come about. But anyway, it's just a matter. It's just a matter of letting nature. It's just a matter of trying to be graceful instead of fighting it all the time.
And how is your health considering your weight?
Oh, thus far, great. Great blood pressure. No blood sugar problems. You know, I know, because Chris Christie just went through this whole public thing about weight. On the weight question, I'm really interested in a result from last year where, when weight loss surgery disrupts a portion of the digestive tract, diabetes disappears in a day in some patients. You know, it's like just crazy. And so there's something maybe to do with bacterial populations that we don't understand. And my feeling is that the science is moving pretty fast. And I kind of want to, for myself, I probably wouldn't make the same decision he did just yet. I want to see a bit more information. So thanks for asking. So far, I'm doing great. I understand the statistics for being a heavy person suggest that one should be worried.
But you're not.
I've worked a lot with doctors and surgeons because I made the first surgical simulator, and I worked a lot on modeling brains and stuff. So I've gotten a doctor's perspective on how to balance statistics with individual cases and how fragile everybody is, really. And I think... I think the best strategy for the moment, since I don't have problems, is to relax and wait and see a bit. In the term of the next few years, I might do something. I don't know. I mean, I think these are not easy decisions because we have only impartial information, and that's colored in a way by all kinds of interests, because there's commercial people trying to sell you, you know, like you see lap band advertisements on the side of buses. And when you're in an environment like that, it's very hard to get a balanced view.
Jarrett Lin here. His new book is titled Who Owns the Future? I've so enjoyed talking with you.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinker, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Casey Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, and Daniel Knight. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the